Today's healthcare can be confusing, frustrating, and at times downright scary. Here to help with clearing up the confusion, putting an end to the frustration, and making it a lot less scary, here from Los Angeles are your hosts, Eric and Roy, on the Informed Patient Radio Show.
Well, welcome back to part two of the Informed Patient Radio Show. And before we get back to our part two conclusion of our interview with USC LA County Emergency Room Nurse Joanne, let's go ahead and we're going to start with part two of discharge planning. As you recall, part one of our discharge planning of a four-part series, we talked about the importance of a good discharge plan and how it affects good outcomes. So let's go a little bit further and let's start talking about like who should be involved with discharge planning. Well, it's probably obvious the first person should be involved is you. Yes, you. And also the practitioner or MD or physician who is taking care of you as the attending in the hospital. Now, there's a couple of attendings that are in the hospital. Today, we're starting to see the trend of using what we call a hospitalist. A hospitalist is a physician, or also, as a side note, can be a physician assistant or nurse practitioner who generally works under another hospitalist that's part of a hospitalist group. But let's talk about the physicians. Now, the physician can be a hospitalist, like I said, and a hospitalist is basically a physician who basically spends his or her time primarily, or their primary job is taking care of patients in the hospital. They do not have office hours, and basically their office can be in the hospital or very close to the hospital. Like they could be attached to a medical group, or they could be a part of a hospitalist group. Again, could be stationed in the hospital or out just outside the hospital. Or it can be your primary care doctor. There are a few primary care doctors that still will admit patients to the hospital and follow them in the hospital. Now, we're going to have an entire segment on this topic, the hospitalist versus primary care doctors, in terms of attending. But let's just talk about just the doctor who was your attending, and they're going to discharge you. Now, remember, we talked about setting expectations. Let's say you were in for something. Let's say you're in for an infection or something, and the doc says, okay, your lab counts and your vital signs are improving. Say your vital signs are now stable. Your lab work is improving. Your white count, which is a high white count, is indicative of an infection. Say it's starting to trend down. It's not completely normal yet, but it is trending down. And they think you should be on another 14 days of IV antibiotics or by mouth antibiotics. Well, again, you and the doctor, the attending, should really have a clear understanding what the game plan is when you leave the hospital. And it's also partly your responsibility to ask the questions too. Don't let that doctor leave the room until you fully understand the plan. And a lot of hospitals are starting to go to a written plan. So it's okay if you want to ask for a written plan. So a lot of times now when you get new instructions about medications, you might come into the hospital, you know, you already have pharmaceuticals that you take on a regular basis. But since you came into the hospital, there was a change of condition that you know, made it possible for you to have to go into the hospital. So the doctor or the attending has the ability to maybe change your regimen or add or subtract medications. And that's usually reflected on what's called a med reconciliation sheet. And this med, we call it a med rec, the doctor will manipulate, because we do, when you get admitted to the hospital, the nurse will ask, or sometimes a pharmacist or a pharmacy tech will then go over, what medications are you taking and how frequently? That's because in my book, I also say, if you're going to come into the hospital, have your family bring all your medications. And it's also a good idea to always have them written down, you know, maybe type it up, and then have an updated list of the medication, what it's for, how often you need to take it, and if you have refills. It's always good to have somebody bring that into the hospital. If you don't have that, bring in the medications. A pharmacy tech can go through them totally, and they will create a med rec. At the discharge time, the physician will then modify that med rec. Now, what's a great part about that med rec, it also doubles as a prescription. So you can take that then to your pharmacist. The pharmacist, if you go to a really good pharmacist, they'll have an accounting of all the meds you take, and they can see the changes, make the changes that's appropriate, and then dispense what you need. So that is a written documentation. You can also get written plan. Also, you can request information about your ailment that brought you into the hospital. So that way you can educate yourself about, first of all, how'd you get that? What led to it? What is the standard treatment? And what's the standard follow-up or treatment that's required outside the hospital? So that way you're educated. Maybe you can kind of prevent, along with the doctors and the whole team and yourself, you can maybe prevent it from happening again. Because really, who wants to be in the hospital laying in that hospital bed? I'm telling you, it's no vacation. So the attending is your primary go-to. It was also a great idea. Say your attending was a hospitalist or was a panel doctor, but it wasn't your primary care doctor. You do have the right to ask that doctor who admitted you to have constant communication with your primary care doctor. It'd be great if you have the phone number, but they'll be happy to call your primary care doctor, fill them in, and send them anything they need. So that way they can pick up the ball after you leave, and then they can understand what happened, and they should work with you for trying to keep it from happening again. So it's all about the communication. The next person involved in your discharge plan is your nursing team. The bedside nurses that take care of you. Always have a good open communication with them, and also express any knowledge deficit that you might have. Like if you're going to go for a test, or you're about to be discharged and you have any really good questions, or you have questions at all, ask the nurses. A lot of times they're going to have the answer for you. And if they don't, they'll reach out to the physician right away and get that information for you. Another additional member of the team is a combination. It's the case manager and discharge planner. Now, in some cases, the case manager also acts as the discharge planner, but there are times when they're separate entities. Like, at a big hospital, it could be the case manager is a nurse, the discharge planner could be a social worker, or it could be a lower licensed person, or it can be a non-licensed person that's taking direction from the licensed case manager. Case managers, for the most part, are always licensed nurses, whether it be an RN or LVN, but their function is exactly the same. So they're there to help you get the whole package together for you. The case manager, it's always a good idea for the case manager, and it's protocol for the case manager to meet with you 24 hours within 24 hours up to admission. And they, too, help reinforce expectations. They're real good experts and knowing the guidelines, and they'll kind of talk to you about, like, this is when we anticipate you being discharged, but of course, things change, and that's okay. And what they'll get to know about, what's your support system like at home, your friends, family. You know what? They'll ask questions like this, and it might sound silly, but it does help. They'll ask, like, do you live in an apartment or house? Do you live in a one-story, two-story, or even a three-story home? Do you have pets in the home? Who do you live with? Do you drive? Do you use any medical equipment like a walker, wheelchair, cane? How's your support system? Do you have transportation to and from the hospital? That kind of stuff. Because all of that stuff, can affect good outcomes and discharge planning. And so, say you don't have transportation home. That's a barrier to discharge. We do have patients in that come in, and their friend's support system is not really there. And some people really don't have family, or their family's in New York and they're admitted to the hospital in LA. So that could be a barrier to discharge. So if we can identify those barriers early, we could help resolve some issues. And there's a lot of resources out there that the case manager can tap into using the social workers. So if you think that there's going to be any kind of barrier to you successfully discharging and having a smooth transition of care, that's the time to really let the case manager know. The case manager can really reach out to a lot of different resources and really come to a resolution. We're not going to kick you out of the hospital. If there's times where the case manager can put a halt to the discharge, if the case manager does not feel there's a safe discharge, or if there's going to be maybe an instance where if they discharge you, you're just going to turn right around and come right back, then that's readmission rates are really looked on, except for, let me back up. It's better to have an extra day in the hospital when it comes to like Medicare standards and guidelines or anything, then in readmission. So that's a plus for you. So, and also if you have some reservations, now please, it's not a good time to say, gee, I really like the food and I like the bed, so that's why I want to stay. We do have some patients that just like to stay because they feel safe there. I get it. We all get it. But, the hospital is the hospital. But if you really think that there's going to be a really big barrier and you feel that you might just end up back in the hospital because, and not really because you're not feeling, that well and everything. I'm talking about like you might not have means of obtaining your prescriptions for a day or two. Other things like that. Let the case manager know. Let him or her start working on a resolution early on. The discharge planner is there also to help set up anything you might need, like home health or going to another facility or any kind of medical equipment. They're there and they'll come in and ask you a lot of things. And they'll also explain if you have a certain type of insurance that A, is it covered and are there going to be any copay? So they'll help you with that. The additional team members that will be involved with your discharge plan can involve physical therapists, occupational therapists, respiratory therapists, maybe, and pharmacists and social workers. The PT and OT, physical therapist, occupational therapist, they will, if the attending physician thinks maybe you're a little deconditioned or say you were in for surgery or they feel like maybe you came in for a pneumonia, now you've been in bed for a couple days, and believe it or not, being in bed for over 24 hours, there's a certain percentage of deconditioning that happens through the human body. So the physical therapist can come in, an occupational therapist, and do an evaluation and kind of detect how much deconditioning has happened and make recommendations. If you're in the hospital, like say for a week, you can be pretty much deconditioned and you might maybe need some outpatient physical therapy in the home or at a skilled nursing facility or an outpatient facility that does physical therapy. So they're team members that you really want to talk to, and they'll do an exam and they'll put you through some paces and they'll ask you a lot of questions about like what kind of things you home. Are you living in a two-story or one-story home? Do you drive? Do you use any equipment and such? So unfortunately, you'll be asked those questions multiple times, but bear with them. Everybody's just really trying to get a clear picture so they can help you get better and have great outcomes. The other piece of the puzzle with all the people are, of course, your friends and your family. If you have a good support system, it's always good to involve a family member or a good trusted friend that understands the discharge plan as well as you do, or maybe you're on some good pain medications and the thinking process might be a little bit askew. Your friend or family member could be there as a backup and they can obtain a lot of information from the attending and the team as well. So it's always good to have that support. And again, if you don't have that support, let the case management staff know, and also let your attending physician know early on. It's okay. Not everybody has a great support system, and so we're here to help. So let's talk about briefly, and we'll go into great detail later on in our other segments, but let's say you're going to go home and the physician staff would like you to have some home health. Now, let's talk about what things can happen in home health. Home health can do a lot these days. It's getting better. And the old thinking was, the patients need to be in the hospital for you know, a couple weeks, and literally until you feel like you're ready to run a marathon, then the docs go, okay, you're ready to go home. But that was back when medicine wasn't that expensive, and Medicare and the insurances paid, and, you know, until they started doing, insurance companies started kind of poking around saying, well, you know what, you know, what is the delay? Are we just kind of doing things at a leisurely pace, or, you know, and we do have a responsibility to our members and the premiums and other things like that. So they started, you know, research studies were done and other things, and they started realizing, you know, patients really don't need to be in the hospital this long. If their labs are trending to the good side, you know, trending like the white count's trending down, or the hemoglobin, hematocrit, which tells you how much blood you have in your body, is trending up, well, you're on the road to recovery. And, you know, if everything it kind of goes to plan, you should recover. So they start experimenting with, well, can we send patients home and maybe do some stuff there? You know, because we're going to do it anyway. Maybe the patient would rather be home. I think I'd rather be home. So things we can do these days, IV hydration, IV antibiotics. We can do IV nutrition, which is called TPN. We can do tube feedings into the stomach. If, like, say you can't really eat, maybe something's wrong with your esophagus, or you just can't, you won't be able to eat for some time, we can do tube feedings at home. Advanced wound care, yes, can be done at home. So a lot of stuff can be done at home. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, respiratory therapy. Social workers could come out to your house and kind of follow up with you on resources and other things like that. In fact, here's a side note. For those of you who are getting Medicare and thinking about doing the old standard fee-for-service Medicare or possibly a Medicare Advantage program, let me tell you something. There are some medical groups and Medicare Advantage programs that are really pulling out all the stops to help people and keep them very comfortable and keep them out of the hospital in a safe manner. They're even bringing back, get this, the physician house call. And also, there's a program called Hospital at Home. Isn't that wild? You show up to the emergency room and say you come in with an infection. But in the old days, they used to admit you for it. Nowadays, if the physician thinks that can all be taken care of safely at home, they'll send you home. Okay, the physician, a physician, or maybe even that physician that saw you, will follow up with you at your home. He or she will come to your home. IV antibiotics will be ordered through a home health agency and an infusion company. A nurse will go out and the whole deal, physical therapy or wound care nurse and all that kind of stuff. They'll take care of you at home. Imagine that. They'll order all the equipment and take care of you at home. Isn't that awesome? Here's the kicker. All that is actually a fraction of the cost of you being admitted to the hospital. And you're in the comfort of your own home. You can be watching your favorite televisions on your shows on Netflix and Hulu and all that kind of stuff. And the doctors and everything are coming to you. Is that the coolest thing or what? Also, the Medicare Advantage program, you know, like another side note, sometimes they'll pay for healthy programs like gym memberships, nutrition classes, and they'll give you gobs and gobs of information, and they'll bend over backwards to help with your ailments and manage your care. They'll update you on when you should have refills. Sometimes they'll even automatically order from. The program is phenomenal, and it's happened within the last 5 years, and I am absolutely blown away. So really look into it. Really dig a little deeper. I think you'll be surprised what you find. Now let's get back to the discharge planning. Say you're going to go home and you need IV antibiotics. No problem. The discharge planner will take the order from the doctor, and what they automatically do is they run your benefits. Or what they do is they send it to a company, like say an infusion company, because they have to supply the antibiotics, and then a home health company, they'll supply a nurse that's qualified to set up the IV and administer it to you. Well, those companies will run your benefits. They'll run the benefits. They'll get back to the discharge planner. Sometimes, like say it's Medicare, and you just have straight Medicare A and B. What they'll do is they will tell the discharge planner, is there going to be any out-of-pocket? If so, it could be like a 20% copay, and the discharge planner can give you an idea how much that's going to be, and then you can see if that's a feasible thing. Again, they try to do this early on, so if there's any barriers, you know, the hospital or the case managers, they can work with resources and maybe try to help you out on that. That's with that. And you go home, and the infusion companies will send the antibiotics or the fluids or whatever needs to be infused into you. And then a home health company will contact you and say, we're going to send a nurse out at such and such time. And they come out and they interview you, do a quick assessment and everything. They start infusing, and then they talk to you about education on how to keep the area of IV clean and dry. And in some cases, if you're teachable, what they like to say, then it's sometimes they could, after a couple visits, you might feel comfortable administering yourself. I know that sounds a little scary, but the home health companies have devised ways of making it real easy to do. There's these, like for instance, you can get a pump that you just hang the bag in the tubing, put it through. It's easy. You hit the on button, you hit a couple buttons, were real easy, and you hit start. And that little the little pump can fit in a large style fanny pack, believe it or not. Sorry. And then there's also other medications that they could administer stuff through that's like in a little ball, the size of maybe a grapefruit. And what that does is when you open up a certain valve, the barometric pressure on the outside will collapse the ball at a certain rate. That translates to a certain drip rate, which is great. So you don't have to worry about it. You put it in a little fanny pack, and the thing is collapsing, and it's administering itself. Sometimes it can be in a syringe. You can administer it yourself. So believe me, it's not too complicated. And they'll assess whether they feel that you can do it okay. If not, they'll just continue coming out within reason and do the infusion for you. Now, other things that can happen with home health, physical therapy. Or let's go back to the RNs. A nurse can come out. Maybe you have a wound. Maybe the doctor's like, maybe you were just diagnosed with diabetes. Or say you're diabetic, but maybe you need a little reinforcement and support on how to check your sugars and maybe inject insulin. Or say we're sending you home with Lovenox, which is a blood thinner, and you need to inject yourself. Well, the nurses can come out and do education on how to properly perform injections, how to check your blood sugars, how to perform basic wound care. They also can come out and do what we call med compliance checks. And what that is they can go over all the medications that the doctors have sent you home with, and we'll go over every medication with you, make sure that you can identify it, make sure, and believe me, this is not to put anybody down, but there is a certain segment out there, and they shouldn't be embarrassed of this. There is a certain segment out there of people who have a little trouble reading, and that's okay. But I like to encourage people, if you can't read, or maybe your eyesight's not that great, or there might be a barrier, it's not a good idea always to look and say, oh yeah, that pill looks like my, so I'm going to take that one. Because some pills can look alike, and we've seen people come into the emergency room because they overdosed, because they were relying on the fact that they thought that the look of the pill was the pill that they thought they should be taking. But if you're having any kind of difficulty, let the nurse know. They can devise different things. Like I've seen them do a color chart where they'll put like a little mark, like a green mark on this bottle means you take this, and then they'll put a little chart, take it at morning and night. One at morning and one at night. An orange means to take it three times a day. Stuff like that. So there's always a way. Okay. Or they might be able to help you arrange a pill box or anything. So they're going to go over the medications, what they're for, why you should take it, and the safe way to take it. So it's an invaluable. Also, they can also do safety evals. Are the areas around the furniture clear? Are there any hazards that might be tripping hazards at night and everything? It's an invaluable service, and it's paid for by insurance. So take advantage of that. Other things that can happen is physical therapy and occupational therapy can come to your home and help you get back on your feet, so to speak. So they can be invaluable. And also, like I said, social workers can come to your home. And in some cases, going back to the Medicare Advantage programs, a pharmacist can call you and go over your medications as well. So they're really getting better at the home health. So let's stop for right now. In our next segment, we're going to talk about medical equipment and how that plays in to discharge planning. And then we'll talk about really good follow-ups. And then hopefully we'll and our four-part series on discharge planning. So after the break, we're going to come back to our part two interview with Joanne, who is an emergency room nurse at LA County USC Hospital Emergency Room. So stay right there, and we'll see you after the break. So this is a good segue into a lot of patients, and when I used to work emergency room too, you know, they would arrive and they have their particular complaint that they would like to be seen by the staff. The waiting room's kind of full, but, you know, they would notice that some patients that arrived, you know,
after them,
they go into the back. And of course, the question is, hey, wait a minute, I got here first. Why did they go in? And I think this is a good topic to maybe bring up right now.
Yes.
Of how you guys determine who comes in first, second, third, or why is it? Maybe you can let our audience know why is it that that happens sometimes? Why
right.
do people that show up later get seen faster?
So that's a question that comes up a lot because mm-hmm. we also have a room called Room 2, and that nurse is in charge of reassessing and vitaling patients every 4 hours.
Okay.
So you can, if patients are waiting 18 hours, you're calling them in that room a lot. And mm-hmm. even when you're not calling them, everybody from the waiting room is coming in and wanting to know why they're waiting and
sure.
why that person went ahead of them.
Right.
So I say, we have different areas. We have an ortho area,
right.
a really sick area, a resuscitation area, a peds, an ER, a jail,
mm-hmm.
blah, blah, blah. And I say, each patient is assessed in that room right next door to me, room 7, where all those people are. And there's usually a packed room.
Wow.
We have to take the sickest people first. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. usually a respiratory issue, breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to explain to them the ABCs. Airway issues are always going to come first.
Right.
You have to breathe. There's nothing else to
It's kind of nice to breathe.
Yeah, airway first. So sure. if someone's coming in with asthma and you have a really bad broken arm, we can help you with medication. But if we don't take that patient back right now, they might not survive.
Correct.
I try to explain it to them. There's people that are acutely ill. Some people understand. They get it. They're pretty smart. And
yeah.
some people don't get it.
Just
I say, I have a chemo
patient. A
little
bit of a challenge.
Yeah. yeah, I have a chemo patient. Extremely sick. Febrile. Can't really be around all this. They
sure.
have no white count as it is.
Yeah.
I got to put a mask on them. I got to try to get them in a room.
Yeah.
Besides the fact, should a patient like that really be sitting in a waiting room?
Right. Yep.
If you have a broken leg, I know it sounds horrible, but at county, you know, in a private hospital, broken leg, they're going to really try to help you out, yeah. put mm-hmm. you at least on a gurney. We don't have those options.
Right.
We will medicate you and make you comfortable, but we don't have anywhere for you to lay down.
Yeah. yeah.
And so I try to explain that to them. And most people are pretty good. Uh-huh. You know, I'll say, you know, if you don't want to wait, you know, you have the option for your med refill. If you don't want to wait the 10 hours in the ER,
sure.
you can go up to the clinic on the mm-hmm. second floor. You know, there's a big sign that says the clinic is open and you can go there, but most people don't see it.
Yeah.
And they say, well, I come here for everything.
Yeah.
So we have those obstacles, but, you know, we try.
So bottom line is for the you take the sickest first.
We do.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not
And it's really
It's not
sick.
First come, first serve. It's whoever's sickest.
However, we do have fast track, and
yeah.
we try.
Which tries to help, yeah.
Right.
Okay, very good.
So, John, when you're working in the emergency room, I know there's different people in charge of different things, but who's ultimately in charge overall in the emergency room? Is that a physician, or is it a charge nurse? Or
We have a nurse. I don't know all her degrees, but
right.
there's a lady, Sheila, mm-hmm. who is in charge of, oversees everybody as
okay.
far as
Even
nursing.
The physicians and a lot of things, too?
She pretty much is in charge of...
Pretty much directs them.
Everything, for, yeah.
yeah.
And then there's a physician. There's a newer physician there who recently came on board
mm-hmm.
When Dr. Henderson left.
I see.
He was there for quite a few years. And then Dr. Newton was once the head, and Dr. Mallon, I think they were your
his name.
Yeah, and there's a newer physician, like I said, and he's new. I haven't really had
okay.
any introduction to him. But Dr. Newton was the main, you know, ER physician that was in charge. And there was a Dr. Kim, but he's actually leaving and going to All of You. So there's always somebody, and then there's the nursing, you know, there's nursing managers.
Well, nursing sounds like they pretty much run the show overall. So.
They do. They do. And Sheila's in charge. Okay. So when we have to answer to something, or our nurses have, our nurse managers and our A&Ms have to answer to somebody, it's Sheila.
Okay.
And I believe the physicians as well.
Yeah.
And you'll see her walking around quite a bit with the physicians and everybody. She's very involved.
Good, good. What kind of interactions take place in the emergency room with the say the fire department or the police, paramedics? You have a lot of different people visiting, and can you highlight a little bit on that? Like, do they just drop and go, or
Police that come in, depending on what they're bringing in. Sometimes they're just bringing in somebody that's intoxicated. If they're in handcuffs, they have to go through the ambulance ER.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want them coming through the front ambulatory area. We want to bring things that are in cuffs or violent in the back.
Yeah.
We do, however, get people that walk in that are violent or very ill through the front, because people don't call for ambulances there unless you're homeless or and you just need a ride. But the really sick people never call. So we have the police are bringing in patients in cuffs that are in custody, 5150, which is a psych hold for, you know, suicidal home.
And some of these have, they have their own rescue too, right? Doesn't the sheriffs have their own rescue department? Does they bring
We have people bringing people in, sheriffs, and then we actually have the sheriffs in on the campus.
Right, exactly.
And we call them many times during the day for abusive patients, patients that are becoming violent, or patients that are not cooperating, and, you know, because there's a lot of drug use and alcohol. And then we have a huge psychiatric emergency room, and we also have the walk-in psych is part of our ER.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of issues in there. We have a code green team, which is now, you know, it's like, I think I explained to you, like, that we have, it's the non-violent behavioral team. They come in and they, you know, we try to talk people down from, you know, so we don't have to put them in restraints. You go through it. So they're the team that's you know, we have juvenile hall. So we have correctional officers coming in all day long.
Mm.
Some days, many patients, and some days just a few. So we have juvenile hall correctional officers. We have corpsmen, firemen. And, oh, we have the helipad. So we have the flight, you know, we have the in-flight nurses you know, the, what do you call the main guys on the helicopter? The, I know pilot? There's a name for it. Not the pilot, but the guys that take care of the patients.
Rescue paramedics.
Well, they sometimes are paramedics.
Yeah, paramedics. But
nurses, too, a lot of times are RN paramedics.
They have special cert, I know.
Well, I know the LA, like the fire department run helicopter system. Those are paramedics. And the private systems, like, you know, like Life Flight and everything.
Life Flight, right.
Those are, could be a paramedic and a nurse that's a critical care.
Right.
You know, nurse or a CEN.
There's definitely
or an
like major training that goes along with that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So we have the helipad that's extremely busy all day. It lands quite
a bit.
Yeah. So we have HMAs, which are hospital medical assistants.
Okay.
And we have them, and they are great. They run and they grab equipment. They go with patients to CT when they're intubated. Cool. They run codes with everybody. Mm-hmm. They do CPR. They set up the pumps and the rapid the fluid. I forget the name of it. You know, it infuses fluid into you rapidly. The rapid infuser.
Right, I was going to say it's rapid infuser.
I couldn't think. They have all of this. Like, that's where the MICN comes in. The radio takes a call. Boom. She alerts the
team.
The recess.
Yeah.
The team. Everybody runs, gets everything ready. They get chest tubes ready. Depending on what's coming in, they usually know. They have a chest tube ready. They have rapid diffusers ready. They have warming blankets, cooling blankets for, you know, like MI. They have, They have the corpsmen. They come in.
The corpsmen.
The corpsmen.
Are these from the military?
Yes, they come in. We have the Navy comes in. Right. I'll see them a couple nights a week. They have okay. the Navy doctors come in.
Yes.
They have everybody. They have firefighters in training, paramedics in training.
Very nice.
They have junior volunteers.
Oh, nice.
The place is just...
Do you get any of the Air Force PJs, the pararescue jumpers? Like...
Yeah, do no, they come in? You know, they might. Navy, yeah. They, it's mostly Navy, yeah. yeah. Mostly Navy and it the corpsmen?
Corpsmen.
Corpsmen, yeah. The corpsmen. They come in. They, it's great. I mean, it's just...
Which is what Eric was. He was attached to a combat unit.
Yeah, no, they're there all the time. Yeah. They're great. They're a big part of the, you know, part of the ER. And, you know, they do a lot. They're great. They're
great
helpful.
Place to train.
Everybody. I mean, it's just a whole...
Where can you get that kind of training? Otherwise, unless you're actually in a war.
You really can't. I mean, when just a baby's being born or there's a trauma, I mean, you know, from the radio to the room in 5 minutes, you just see everything is laid out and there must be 50, 60 people there. You've got pharmacy, RT, there's crash cart, there's monitors, everything. It's just a
well-oiled
machine.
Trying to figure out all that. It's
amazing.
Got to be down to a science
what
to
they
do, that.
Do there.
Yeah.
I mean,
does a primary care doctor ever come into the emergency room to visit their patient? I mean, that sounds really weird, but I just
not really.
Curious. Yeah, I was going to say
specialty.
They think they wait till they get on the floor. Yeah.
the people you see the most in our ER is neurosurgery and cards.
Yeah, yeah.
Cardiology. Okay.
Right.
I mean, because it's the GSW rate is pretty
high.
Pretty high. Yeah. So.
All right.
So what are the primary ailments you get? I mean, would you say it's trauma, or is it an even mix between like stroke and heart attacks, or what's the balance on all that?
Well, we're working on becoming a stroke receiving center, so we're working on our stroke stuff right now. That's up and going and going very well. In fact, the stroke stuff's gone from okay to really good. I mean, they're catching stuff. Right in the front. Actually, I caught an interesting stroke I'll tell you about.
Yeah, well, I know the first few minutes or first 15, 20 minutes of what you do can make huge
I do
difference.
A position a lot in the front called the router.
Yeah.
So basically, I get everything in the front through the glass doors that you would think would come by a helicopter or a car, but they come through the front. Yeah. And I can screen somebody in a minute and have them where they need to be.
Yeah.
Either in the waiting room, waiting for triage, or in a booth, or in recess, like that.
Do you have a code stroke? I know some places are doing
we do.
That. Do you?
We have a code stroke, and we have... Okay, so we see some stroke patients. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of people with symptoms that you think might be stroke, but it could be Bell's palsy or just neuropathy or whatever.
Sure.
We see a ton of diabetics. Mm-hmm. A lot of, I need a refill, I need to check. A lot of high sugars, low sugars. Mm. Those are emergencies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We see a ton of ortho, including Palmdale. Everybody comes from, we seem to be the only ortho center around. We see a ton of ortho. We see a ton of liver disease. Mm. A ton of liver disease. We see a lot of cancer. Obviously, a ton of trauma.
Yeah.
A lot of ETOH abuse.
Sure.
A lot of drug abuse, a lot of overdose, a ton of suicidal ideation, a ton of, I mean, pregnancy. This is my typical day in the front.
Sounds overwhelming just listening to it.
Yeah. Juvies, behavioral, even the peds. I cannot tell you how many kids I register for suicidal ideation. Little kids, I mean. And, you know, we see the defiant disorder, you know, kids acting out in school. We see a lot of abuse. Sexual and violent. We see, it's interesting, crimes of passion. I see things in this ER. I mean, there'll be and this is true. I mean, it just happened and it happens a lot. Someone's in the bed. They've been beat up, shot, whatever. The wife's there and the girlfriends are waiting outside.
Oh,
I mean, the stuff that it's just the fighting.
Made for TV.
Yeah. I see a lot of fights in the lobby. I see people hitting. I see people yelling.
Yeah.
I see people taking their clothes off. I mean, there's a population of really bad mental illness and desperation because they have no money and nowhere to go. Yeah. And then I also see that the wait times can all the anxiety. We see a ton of anxiety, a lot of stomach pain, gallbladder, and all of this stuff waits in the lobby. Mm. And you see a lot of like people escalating into anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
I see a lot of a lot of people coming into the ER that look perfectly fine and that really are okay, but they've had a pain, and so they're coming to the ER because they don't really know where else to go. Mm-hmm. Because you do see the people that are really, truly sick, and they look sick. Mm-hmm. And then I get people that are, you know, come in. A lot of this is they come in, they look great. The makeup's on, the hair is done.
Yeah.
They're wearing high heels. They're eating Popeyes from across the street, and they're checking into the ER for stomach pain.
Oh, that must have been Eric.
So you get a lot of just, you know, they don't have anywhere else to go.
Yeah.
So that's what we see. And then a ton of trauma. And then you get the, you know, train wrecks.
Oh, yeah.
Got hit by a bus.
Yeah. Sure.
I was going to ask you about the term, train wreck. Is that a term they still use, like, in the emergency room? I mean, where it's not really a train wreck, but it's just a lot of, you're just like overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And how does that work with the triage, and who decides? Is it still nursing, or is it the docs on that too? Or?
Well, they say, you know, the A&Ms will call and say, like, recess is saturated. We're in a sham. That's the nursing lingo. A sham means we're really in bad shape. It's a train wreck back there. You'll hear that.
Sure.
Kind of. That's just the nursing lingo.
Yeah.
But basically, sure, we'll get saturated. We're in black. Mm. And that's, like, if you look at the documentary, it's called Code Black.
Yeah.
Because we are typically in black. We are saturated beyond.
Sure. Mm. Right.
And it's just that's what we say. We're in black.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what the A&Ms will, they'll call the nurse and they say, hey, I need so-and-so to peel off to wherever. We're in black. We're in black. We're in black.
And that's a good segue into a good question, which I, you know, since, you know, I've had my ER time as well, and friends and family will always seem to, you know, like to watch all these television shows on TV.
Yes.
And I do get asked sometimes, it's like, does that really happen? Does those little things and stuff? So I would like to see if we can talk about a little bit of your experience as an ER nurse, and then what you see both in television shows and in the news, or sometimes people coming in with these preconceived notions, like one I can always say is, you know, like there's a famous show on television and the doctors seem to run the CAT scan. So I mean,
or give the shot or something.
Yeah, I tell patients, no, that they don't run the CAT scan.
And they're not standing over them watching.
Absolutely.
Going, wait, did you see that?
Yeah. That's so not happening. So maybe you can kind of shed a little bit of light on you know, the differences between the media portrayal of the emergency room versus reality.
Yeah. So basically, the nurses triage, and that's true, and decide and treat right from the front, and then doctors are waiting in the back, and they're getting a report from you on usually acuity 2 patients.
Mm-hmm.
If there's no beds, that's who's going back.
Right.
They're looking at EKGs. Okay, thanks. Boom. They're back on to whatever they were doing. Writing orders. That's it.
Right.
The nurses do everything else.
Right.
CT calls, the nurse is putting them on monitor, taking them to CT. The HMAs are helping out. If there's food trays that need to be, you know, retrieved, the NAs are doing it, and the nurses. And yes, these doctors will do go beyond what they really would do in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
They will go grab lunch trays and food and shoes.
Well, that's good. Yeah.
It's good
and
to
they
hear,
do.
Yeah.
Oh, the county doctors do a lot. They
that's
set
good.
Up their own trays.
But for your typical emergency room, I would imagine, like, for instance, I knew that when a chest painter would come in at some of the ERs I worked at, the nurses had the, like, what we called standing orders and had
Mona.
Hmm?
The Mona.
Yeah. Some of them had what they can bring the patient back and start things like you start an IV line, draw some blood, check a troponin level, you know, and get the IVs going, get nitro paste and start
aspirin.
Some morphine and have them chew on aspirin way before the physician or the practitioner comes in to assess the patient. In other incidences, other than chest pain, do the nurses still have that same leeway to get a lot of the stuff, the standard stuff, started before the practitioner even sees the patient?
Yes. Well, we can do what we're doing now is when you come to the router and you have a chest pain, and regardless whether your chest pain's real or not, whether you're 5 or 100, chest pains go above everybody. Mm-hmm. An EKG is right. called immediately.
Yeah.
So now EKG is called immediately. You have a good EKG or a bad EKG. There's right. a nurse practitioner or PA or both up front. Mm-hmm. They're immediately looking at your EKG. If it's not good, you're calling for a booth.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
All right.
And we can, yes, in the booth, put you on oxygen.
Sure.
Get your vitals, you know, do whatever. But doctors will write orders for aspirin stuff. Now, in triage, we can give Motrin, Tylenol, and Maalox. Those okay. are the, and Zofran. Those are the meds we can give.
Okay.
We cannot order saline because you got to worry about people with fluid sure. issues.
Right.
We don't give aspirin. We're okay. not allowed to do that because people have issues with bleeding.
Well, I'm talking past triage when they're in the back.
Doctors are writing orders already. Somebody's writing okay. an order. And that's why we have the NPs and PAs. Because
okay.
if a physician is off in a booth, let's say dealing with something that's been going on, an NP okay. is going to run over to your booth. They know EFC's alerting that they're bringing a possible STEMI or whatever. They're already writing orders. Somebody is writing orders, whether it's the doctor, the NP, PA, somebody's writing an order and calling cardiology already.
It's good that your staff that way. Well, I think a lot of things have changed with the presence of nurse practitioners and physician assistants and yeah. all aspects of the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now, you can still say to, hey, doc, you know, here's this. Oh, yeah, give this, that. I'll put the orders in.
Right.
Right.
So its protocols changed a little bit, and I think, you know, an ICU and ER is different.
Yeah.
But for us, they made it so that an EKG is done within 10 minutes. It's looked at, and mm-hmm. that patient is either. So there's also an area called North Lean Track A and B. So mm-hmm. if all the rooms are full and I have somebody who has a bad EKG, I'm taking the patient to Lean Track A or B, and that physician is coming right over.
Okay.
I'm giving him the EKG, and he's going right to that patient.
Okay, good.
That's priority.
All right.
Okay? Until they're downgraded or not, yeah, or yeah. sent to the STEMI.
Yeah.
Our STEMIs are handled pretty fast.
Yeah. Okay. Like,
it's, yeah.
Now, let's talk, let's help the listening audience out. Are there alternatives to going to the emergency room if yes. it's not life-threatening?
Yes.
Like, for instance, boy, I feel like I have the flu and I feel like I just need to die. Or, I'm not talking about the chest pains or, you know, stuff like that. Just the people that, you know, are not they're not hemorrhaging, you know, right. profusely, other things. What other alternatives can patients do than to show up at the emergency room?
Well, if you have a primary care physician, you could mm-hmm. call him or her.
That's a good idea.
If mm-hmm. you have a nurse practitioner or PA that you see, you could call their office, mm-hmm. either or all.
Okay.
There's urgent care facilities.
Oh, very good.
You could possibly call the 1-800 number on the back of your insurance card,
right.
which most people don't know about. And mm-hmm. there is a number for mental health, for emergency services. For regular
urgent care, maybe too.
Yes, absolutely. You call that 800 number and you say, mm-hmm. yes, I'm a Pacific Care patient or I have whatever, and I'm really sick right now. I think I sure. have the flu and I don't want to go to the ER and wait 25 hours. Do I have options? Well, yes, you do, and let me go over them.
Oh, very nice. That's a good point. Now, can the patient...
And we also have an urgent care, by the way. Sorry.
Oh, very good. Oh. Now, could the... do you think it would be prudent for a typical family or a patient to maybe call ahead to like, emergency room that's close by and say, which are wait times right now, or what do you think?
Well, you know? Yeah, and some... like, Los Robles has a text, yeah. you know.
Okay,
we'll
very
text
nice.
You the wait time.
Nice.
Now, I've heard
with
of that,
the, yeah, and that's the thing with private hospitals now. It's all time.
Yeah.
Everything's time now.
Sure,
time,
sure.
time, time.
Sure.
So get them in.
Right.
That's not going to happen in county because A, it's academics, and sure. B, it's just there's so many people there. But now I'm not necessarily happy with the whole time thing. Now I did a private hospital for about 5 months and it was all about time, and it's everybody's so pressured by the management or whatever
mm-hmm.
to make sure, sure. they're watching
yeah.
the board, make sure that patients get in.
Yeah.
That things are kind of getting a little bit too
yeah.
fast in that situation.
Oh yeah.
So I really think that needs to be looked at in a
yeah.
better way.
Sure.
And I don't think that you should really base it on the time. I think that you should go, like, and if you have to wait for care,
Sure.
And I hear this every day by the county patients. You know, I could go here or there, but when I come here, if I wait at least I know they take care of my problems.
So. Yeah. Okay. That's a good point, too.
It's a good point. Very nice. It really is.
Yeah.
And I hear it all the time.
Okay. And so we're getting a good lesson here in the emergency room.
Yeah. So.
So anyway, I was going to ask you, do patients ever get turned away then in the emergency room?
No, never.
Never?
Never.
Okay.
Never turn away a patient.
That's good.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
Especially for, I think, the partly, probably because you're a county, but also EMTALA here in California, you have to at least make an attempt to stabilize the patient. Yes, absolutely.
You don't put them in a taxi or a bus. And
well, and even with a cold or, I have a runny nose. I mean, they are absolutely are free to check in. And you can also give them their options.
Yes.
We have an urgent care upstairs. I can't really tell them to go there, but if they say, hey, don't you have an urgent care? Sure. I say yes, and you are welcome to go.
Okay. Yeah, that's good.
Can you talk about diversion or what that is, or if that's something that happens with you guys? Or
Well, yeah, we try it.
All right.
So that's for a saturated ER.
Yeah.
That's wearing black. Like, wearing black.
Right. So like if somebody's picked up, because I've seen that too, where eventually the patient comes on the floor and the patient goes, I live way over yonder, and I asked them, I wanted to go to X, Y, and Z hospital, but the paramedics brought me over here.
Yeah.
And then I find out it's because that emergency room was on diversion.
Right.
So, maybe you could talk about, like, if an ER goes on diversion, what does that mean for the patient in the ambulance?
That they're going to the next hospital that can take them.
Yeah.
But
it does happen.
Our population, somehow, even when we're on diversion, which is rare, because I don't think anybody, somehow they end up with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think there's too many hospitals that can handle what we take. Because we're
very few.
We're level
one. There's not too many level ones.
Yeah.
No, I think we're it almost.
Yeah. Most of the ERs out in the community are level three.
Yeah. Right, and I think
you
Northridge,
have a few level twos.
Level two.
Yeah.
I think Los Robles has become a level one.
They might have. I know Northridge and Henry Mayo are level two.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Or you know what? Los Robles is a level two and a stroke receiving.
And a lot of things can be taken care of level two.
But we're pretty much it.
Yeah.
So.
And for listening audience, let you know, level one, two, and three is just what they offer in services. And I also believe level one is reserved for a facility that has both academics and a trauma surgeon on 24 hours a day.
Absolutely.
So, so that's to get level one.
It's probably
call it shock trauma.
It's where you want to go if you're shot.
Yeah.
Or in a bad train wreck.
Right.
Yeah. And usually the helicopters will bring people as much as they can to
and we
level
do.
Ones. Yep.
We get the patients even that are just, riding their horse at the, doing their horse training. And you'll get people, just random people, and, they get thrown off their horse and they're C-spine and helicoptered in.
Absolutely.
And they've got all the insurance in the world. They're coming to us.
Oh, yeah. That's where I would want to go if I had a bad situation or a real heavy-duty situation. I would want to go to the main county hospital.
Me too. And I think I hear that a lot.
Save your life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, people think, oh, it's the county. Oh, they're going to kill you. I don't want to go there. It's like, I got news for you. They got it together.
And they do think that. And it's just odd because they're judging it by the atmosphere and who they're treating. But they don't realize they're looking at the patient population in the area. They're not looking at the physicians and the professors and the great people that come
out
talent.
Here.
Yeah.
That's what people don't understand.
Well, that's where all these other hospitals and all the physicians, they get trained from there, and then they go out into the community.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so. It's crazy.
So, Joanne, how do you, in your opinion, how do you see the future of emergency room medicine down the road, 5-10 years, and what will it look like? Do you see anything on the horizon that you think will change? Or,
well, the change that I have seen in all the years that I've worked, since I was pretty young, is that the emergency room is like a huge clinic now.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, when I was young, you went to the emergency room for a broken leg, really bad, cut that needed stitches, a bad car accident, chest pain.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of a brain event. And then everything else went to the doctor's office.
Yeah.
Well, sure. I remember getting hit by a baseball bat in the face, resulting in a huge lash. And I blacked out the whole thing, ended up in the nurse's office. And I was then sent to my doctor's office. and they turn out fine. Nowhere did they even think we're there to go to the emergency room.
Right?
Yeah, you're right. The mentality was a little different.
Right.
But you are right. The ER seems to become the catch-all.
It is. And, that's a great word for it.
Yeah.
It's the catch-all.
Yeah.
We are definitely an ER clinic.
Sure.
And that's why we're treating from the front because we are getting, you know, 100 med refills a day.
Right.
I'd like my lipoma removed. I'd like my freckles checked. We are the catch-all.
Yeah,
we are
the
diversion to wherever you're going to end up.
Freckles so check like
a,
room two?
Like it's a, well, you know, it's a massive triage center, right?
It is. And I'll get people, they'll come in and they'll say, you know, I've had this ganglion cyst or I have this thing on my wrist. And I know it's a ganglion cyst, which is every... You guys know, and for the public, that it's just a little cyst that does or does not need to be removed. However, if you want it removed, and they'll come to the ER and go, I've had this in my wrist for 20 years. Can they remove it today in the ER? Well, no. A, you shouldn't really be in the ER. You should have gone to a doctor or an urgent care clinic, really. And we have clinics.
Right.
So nobody goes to them, but we have them.
Sure.
Right. Some people do, but most don't. And you try to explain, like, hey, in the future, you know, you can go to one of these clinics.
Yeah.
It's like a regular doctor.
Yeah.
And he'll give you that referral because we're not going to take that out today.
Yeah.
And they're like, what?
Sure.
So these are things. I see the ER becoming just a really big, big doctor's office. And then it's sad because it's taking away from the really critically sick because, you know.
Yes. And so you get more people there. Yeah.
ICU patients aren't going to rooms.
Yeah.
Not like Los Robles. I mean, they're sitting in the ER.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty tough.
It's tough.
So you're seeing the ER just playing more of a dramatic role in triaging and then just
decompressing.
Decompressing and triaging to different areas. And the ER will probably have to get more segmented into being able to adapt to take care of all the different levels of care and stuff like that. So probably go in the same direction, but just get probably way better at it. And as the population grows, your census will get higher.
And I understand it's happening to other hospitals too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Joe, it's been really great having you on the show.
And, thank you.
It's a fantastic episode. I think a lot of people are really going to enjoy this, and we really appreciate you coming down.
And, Thank you. Anyway, so, it was fun.
Good, good.
I love it's my passion to help people and try to educate. So, you know, I enjoy it. So,
perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, well, folks, that's it for this episode. And stay tuned next time where we will continue to share valuable information for you and your loved ones. For more information regarding the show, our guests, and more about us, please visit informedpt.com and then like us on Facebook. We also invite you to tell your friends and your family about the show. So until next time, take care.
You have been listening to the Informed Patient Radio Show with Eric and Roy. For more information, please visit us at informedpt.com. Tune in next time for more information regarding the healthcare system and how it affects all of us.